Listen, the ship is in danger. We have been caught in a 30-minute time loop. And every second that you doubt me brings us all closer to death.
Intruder alert. Shots fired.
Want him locked down.
Drive overload critical.
Wait!
Go, go, go!
Make yourselves at home.
I have.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton passing notes to his friends to keep them alive.
Okay, and we have a very special guest, trapped in a temporal loop, Andy Chan.
Hi guys, I can't believe I'm here again.
Yeah, we can't believe it either.
We've recorded this episode, it seems, like many times now.
At least 57.
Yeah, who's the Stamets of the trio of us?
I think quite clearly it's Andy. Yeah.
Yes, I know what everything that's going on, and I'm just trying to get out of here.
He's sick of this. So, Cam, we just watched episode 7 of Star Trek Discovery. Tell me again, what is the name of this episode?
Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad.
I like that. Okay, mm-hmm. So we're going to tackle this, of course, looking back to previous podcasts that we've recorded. We did one. This is very, very early in our run. It's called Best Recreation Episodes.
Yeah.
Like, we're kind of looking at what people do to have fun in the Star Trek universe. And I guess we discovered that on Star Trek Discovery this week, in
right.
which they throw parties that look like keggers from 1998 at a university.
Wait, I thought this was just your weekend, typically.
Oh, well, and they listen to 200-year-old music.
Yes. Hey, when I go to these keggers over at the university campus, I'm listening to, like, Mozart. I'm cranking the Mozart. It's, you know, what we do there.
Or at least like the Beethoven disco song from Saturday Night Fever.
Yes. You know, Andy, before we dive into this recreation thing, you've been watching Star Trek Discovery the last little while. Tell us a little bit about your thoughts on the series.
Well, I think the best way that I've put it is I'm not really of the opinion. This to me doesn't seem like Star Trek to me. It is Star
Are you
Trek?
One of those kinds of fans?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
This is a Star Trek-themed Firefly.
Okay.
Okay.
I don't understand the Firefly connection. Tell me.
Well, it's more like it's not really about anything of those kind of Star Trek characteristics that I think we've discussed on the podcast before, like exploring the humanity of...
Okay.
What's the humanity? What's humanity going to look like in 400 years or whatever? It's more about, oh, let's see what this kind of... you know, this ragtag crew is going to come up with and what kind of adventures they're going to get into and how are they going to escape from these situations. It's just a dramatic vehicle for these guys.
I'll play devil's advocate, yeah. But don't you think people have been watching new Star Trek series and declaring ever for the last 30 years, oh, that's not real Star Trek. You know, when Next Generation premiered, people are like, that's not real Star Trek. When DS9 premiered, oh, that's not like real Star Trek. So,
I feel like Voyager, then they were like, yeah, that's Star Trek.
No, so, but like, do you get what I'm saying? Like, you're coming here saying, no, it's not real Star Trek. So,
okay,
it's
well,
like,
I guess
what's kind of, why do you think that is, though? Why is this not, why are all the other Star Trek series real Star Trek, but this one isn't?
I think it's more, even if you think of it like as a spectrum, it's not like a binary, this is Star Trek or this is not Star Trek. I would say that. Like Next Generation is closer to the original series, and you know DS9 is a little bit farther away, but
in
still
terms
closer.
Of themes, you're talking to like what it's sort of the aspirational quality, right?
Yeah,
I buy the spectrum like argument. You know, it's further away from kind of that core element that you're talking about.
And I think this Discovery is far. I mean, it's the farthest away from those kind of original. You know, principles or original vision of what, you know, Star Trek was. And then, I don't know, as Ben likes to tell me, so Gene Roddenberry is dead. I got to let it go.
Yeah,
right,
no,
right.
So.
Yeah. I mean, I don't necessarily disagree with you. It does feel in many ways the biggest reinvention we've seen since the original series.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess, I mean, has it been working for you? You know, you're saying it doesn't feel like Star Trek, but as an hour-long show every week, have you been finding it entertaining?
It's been very difficult for me to
kind
to
of
capture,
separate?
To cap, no, it's for to capture my attention. Like I find myself like drifting,
really,
or wanting to do other things. And I'm watching it, but it's like it's similar to how I was watching Voyager.
It's more like you're ready to fold your laundry while
yeah, kind of like that. And I'm just like, I got to watch this because I'm, I got to just make, maybe this episode will be the one that turns it around, and hooks me.
Well, hey, why don't we dive into it with magic and see if maybe this is going to be the one that's turning things all around for Andy, or if we're back to Firefly territory. Hey, Cam.
Yeah.
Are we going to party up like it's, 2155 or what? I forget the exact
year. I'm willing to follow you on whatever year you're going to say.
So when we were talking about like recreation throughout Star Trek series, we've had places like the holodeck that you can have fun there. I guess we kind of have a holodeck aboard the USS Discovery as well.
Yeah.
We've had 10 Forward, which I think is the most popular among fans about like cool hangout spots where we have a lot of parties there.
Quark's Bar is pretty, I think, held in high esteem, too.
But for, like, general fans, though, people, it's 10 Forward. That's
definitely,
what people always go
to. Well, viewer numbers alone would support 10 Forward more.
But I think if you pulled the average fan, they would much rather go to 10 Forward than Quark's. I think you and I are different, where we kind of look at 10 Forward and, like,
we just want to go to the Holosuites.
Well, I don't know. Like, 10 Forward, Barclay's got some programs ready for us, No, but 10 Forward, there's nothing going on there. It's there's just it's dead.
It looks like a hotel bar.
It's for formal functions.
Exactly.
That's where that's where
Andy, what would you prefer? Hanging out at Quark's or hanging out at 10 Forward?
Quark's Bar.
Yeah. You know.
Is there root beer there?
Is there any competition for you? Like, was it Chez Paris or whatever it was called on Voyager or, has there been any other cool hangout spots you've noticed in Star Trek?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think
maybe the beach resort and from Voyager,
The decon gel chamber in Enterprise,
or how about that that cool bar at the beginning of Gambit?
Oh, of course,
with that that piano player
four-armed organist.
Live music.
Yeah. Well, so we didn't get live music here in the galley. We got some remixes of the Bee Gees playing.
That's a rap song from a few. I remember that song being played a lot. I think it was actually played on the trailer for the movie The Big Hit from 1998. Yes, which Avery Brooks plays the villain in. I'm almost positive that that song plays over the trailer. So
maybe that's the Star Trek connection because Avery Brooks was in The Big Hit.
Sure. I'm going to have to go back and watch that trailer, but I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
Okay. So does this look like a fun party to you guys?
You know what? Do I want to be there? Not necessarily. But in terms of Star Trek parties, this may be the wildest one we've seen yet.
Okay, because we've got, Gorkon hanging out and eating food with Kirk and talking. Most uncomfortable dinner scene ever. Up there with Haven, for example. Andy, would this be kind of a bumpin' party that you'd want to be a part of in the Star Trek universe?
Looks like the most fun any of those officers have. Would ever be having.
Yeah.
I mean, the history of Star Trek parties is pretty lame. This felt, to me, actually shockingly like youthful and energetic. Like, it felt like Star Trek cutting loose in a way that I don't think I've ever seen before.
Yeah.
In fact, the entire intro actually reminded me a lot of the opening of Star Trek Beyond with, our central character talking about going through the routine and sort of then having sort of a little bit of the looseness vibe, because at the start of that movie, we see there's hookups and everything on the ship and Kirk's observing. And in this case, we're going from talking about routine to a party and everyone's characters are making out. It reminded me a lot of that opening of Beyond.
Yeah, I didn't even think about it that way, but you're right to a certain degree.
Even opening with a kind of a captain's log, it's not obviously Burnham's not a captain, but opening with a
voiceover,
personal log.
Yeah, the personal log. Okay. I am curious because, I don't know, it seemed very much like a college party, though, in that, everyone's making out with each other.
It's wartime, Tyler.
Yeah. it felt like a Christmas party gone super, super far into the drink mode, and you're macking on coworkers, and it's all your inhibitions are gone here.
I think this is, even this is one of those things where that, to me, that doesn't look like Gene Roddenberry Trek.
I don't know about that. This is like Gene Roddenberry would be all over this party. If he could have gotten away with this back in 1966, Yeah. Oh, he'd be doing something like...
This was like the Gene Roddenberry happy hour every single day.
Oh, no kidding. Yeah. Like, look, the most we got were space hippies, and they made the ship rock out.
Yeah.
And what's the name of that episode? I'm blanking, Cam.
The Way to Eden.
Way to Eden,
but isn't the thing with, those wild parties, it's always... isn't it crew members without, like, non-crew members? Whereas this party looks like to be, like, you know, fraternization and, you know, people not... They're supposed to be professionals. That's what I see in Gene Roddenberry's Star Trek. It's like these Starfleet officers are dedicated to serving Starfleet. They follow. They have like strict rules and procedures.
Well, no,
and
we witnessed a marriage aboard the original series. Uh-huh. Like they're obviously fraternizing with each other.
And like Uhura would be singing in like the break room. And
but it seems like it seems like not. It's not like this where it looks like more like a, you know, a Tinder party or like a hookup situation. You know, it's like real relationships. I think that's it.
I think Andy's reinforcing kind of the very puritanical views of sex that we see.
It's not necessarily my views. I mean, these are Gene Roddenberry.
If you look at Gene Roddenberry the man, I don't think he was all that puritanical.
But Gene Roddenberry the producer.
I would, I'm going to agree with Andy, though, in many ways when we get to maybe the next generation a little more. So
I would say that the next generation is very kind of stuck up on this.
And then I should also like say the caveat that, you know, that's the series that I watched most closely and am most familiar with.
You see shades of kind of the Roddenberry kind of appetites through the Riker character in, you know, season one, mm-hmm. where he's kind of into the holodeck and things like that. But you're right. When, you know, you cut to the crew hanging out, it does feel much more stolid. Then, you know, this episode, especially early on, reminded me a lot of, like, the original series vibe on the ship. And I've often talked how, like, the original series ship seems like the place to be. It's just, like, something fun is happening there all the time. Whereas I wouldn't say that with, you know, Voyager or, Next Generation. But, like,
yeah, what's the most boring ship to serve on, would you say?
I think it might be the next gen, the D.
Okay.
I think so because, you know, on Voyager, you have, like, the beach parties and stuff like that. You have characters like Neelix who are much more, like, fun-oriented. And, I mean, Enterprise, I guess, is the close second, the series Enterprise, because, you know, you have movie night, I guess. Maybe that's the lamest.
The NXO one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I feel like maybe some of the characters on Enterprise would be more fun to hang out with than some of the TNG ones.
Okay. So what's the next wildest party after this one? I'm going to throw this out there, but the stag party from... what's the one where they get married on DS9? It's You're Cordially Invited.
Yeah. I would agree with that.
So we've got some competition there. Andy, what do you think about wild parties in Star Trek? where would you vote?
Oh, you're putting me on the spot here. It's hard for me to think of one off the top of my head.
Okay.
But
there's not a lot. Like, not a lot stand out.
We've got the Voyager Beach Party. We've got the Bachelorette Bachelor Party.
Worf's birthday.
Birthday from Parallels?
No. What was that one with the... Not from Parallels. Isn't the one with the cake, the Troy cake? Wasn't that Worf's birthday?
Oh, that's from Phantasms, isn't
it? Yeah. Oh no, it's the one with the train. The one with the train and the things are taking over the ship.
Right. Where the Enterprise becomes sentient.
Yes.
I don't think that was Worf's birthday, was it? Because he had he had a birthday in Parallels, which is also season seven.
Yes.
So,
What was that cake for then?
I don't recall.
It was a good luck cake for one.
Yeah, it sounds like a real rockin' party if we can't even remember it.
Yeah, I feel like Star Trek is more prone to having terrible parties where, like, you know, it's a character's birthday, they bring out a cake, and it's like, red alert, everyone to the bridge, and like, oh, we're going to have to wait till later. Like, it seems like aborted parties.
Geordi's and Rose Celebration of Life.
Yeah, okay, there's a good one.
That was a real party.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Riker's on the trombone.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say Geordi's date on the beach.
It all comes back to the beach.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
But so, I like this. I like seeing this crew kind of having fun. Like
let loose.
I think one of the problems with Discovery so far has been we don't see the crew kind of having that camaraderie and hangout factor and just kind of being fun together.
Yeah.
This was, we got hints of it last week where, you know, you had Burnham and Tilly running things like that. This, to me, episode really doubled down on that, where it was just like, this episode kind of stood on its own and was just like we're just going to have fun for an hour.
Well, this is actually what I wrote in my notes, though, is like, this actually seems like the first fun episode of Discovery. This is a series that's taken itself very seriously, which is one of my issues with the show, where it's like, Star Trek, go back to every single series, there's a lot of fun happening between the characters. Discovery has not been that until this very episode. So maybe we can segue into the episode itself and talk a little bit about our thoughts here about where we're ranking this. Honestly, for me, the last couple episodes of Discovery, I've really haven't been a big fan of, just on the scale of what we've seen come before. This is probably my favorite episode since the Vulcan Hello at this point. Like,
really? Yeah. That high? Yeah. I mean, it's up there for me.
I mean, we're only 7 episodes in.
Right. So. This is like, I really loved the Butcher's Knife episode. But like, this is, I think, it's probably top 3 for me.
Oh, Andy, where are you thinking this is ranking for you?
Least favorite.
Mm. Wow. Okay. Tell us why.
I found it really unfocused, and the tech kind of didn't make sense to me, and to the point where it was distracting me.
Like,
from
you got too caught up trying to think about the mechanics of the technology.
Yeah, it wasn't. I mean, it was distracting me. I was like, this doesn't make sense. I'm having trouble figuring out how this works, and then it just seems like, well, they just did it this way to move the plot forward, and. And I felt like, in terms of when I mentioned the focus, it seems like they wrote this episode to be an episode about Burnham and Mr. Security Guy.
You mean Tyler?
Oh yeah, Tyler. That's
right. Wow.
But
very forgettable name.
Yeah. Okay.
What I think this episode should have really been about, if they're going to use this plot device, it should have really been about Stamets. And Mud.
No. I thought that was genius that it wasn't from Stamets' point of view, because we've seen that a million times. Yes. Like, oh, it's
Data's point of view, right?
It's from the character's point of view. We see it repeat. They keep trying to convince the person.
Let's just underline. This is the Groundhog formula.
Yes.
Groundhog Day formula.
But yeah. I like the fact that we're coming at it from the other end. You know, we're having a character try to convince the rest of the crew, like, this is what's going on. How can I make you believe me about it? I think there's obvious parallels between the episode Cause and Effect from Next Generation.
Definitely.
I actually kept going back to Remember Me.
I was thinking that too, because Stamets was the traveler.
Well, I was thinking about how Crusher was trying to convince the crew, look, I know this sounds kind of crazy, but please trust me. And the crew was like, okay, we do trust you. And I really like that. Whereas we didn't really necessarily get that with Stamets. There were still, I think, a lot of trust issues aboard the USS Discovery, which makes sense. But I thought the best part was that we weren't just doing like the same tropes over. We weren't coming from Stamets' point of view.
Well, I think because of the nature of the time resetting, it has to still be focused around Stamets. And I think that the way that they could, because otherwise it doesn't make sense. Because each time there's a reset, all of the people other than Stamets and Mud, they're going to be starting from zero.
Yeah.
So how can you make it so that...
I kind of understand what you mean.
I just want to get to the point where...
Yeah, sorry.
I think that if they were not going to focus purely on Stamets, I think their episode could have been about developing a relationship between Stamets and Burnham. Obviously not a romantic relationship, but in terms of like a trust relationship, because this could have been the opportunity where, you know, Burnham's seen as an outsider. It's very hard for her to gain the trust of the crew. And she revealed herself to Stamets, and this could have been like their thing, their secret, where, you know, she gained his trust and he gained her trust. And this was the start of, you know, something bigger, rather than, okay, now this is the story of how Stamets acted as matchmaker between Tyler and Burnham, and that's not a Gene Roddenberry Star Trek characteristic. I don't see that. Whereas I see that, you know, developing this trust, that's more something that would happen in a Gene Roddenberry Star Trek ship.
Yeah, season 1, season 2 of Star Trek The Next Generation.
You know, I kind of understand what you're saying, because, you know, Groundhog Day is the obvious formula for this episode, as well as, you know, the TNG episodes you referenced. But
Cause and Effect actually aired before Groundhog Day did.
Did it?
Yeah.
Interesting.
So Cause and Effect is really the template here.
Oh, wow.
Right. What year was it?
Well, I know Groundhog Day
Were they
is
both 92. like 92?
I believe so.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, you have Groundhog Day, you have Source Code, you have the Happy Death Day, which just came out. In each case, it's the central, the protagonist who's undergoing this. So it's the repetition of the events that cause the change in character. Like in this episode, we're seeing Burnham change over the course of the episode. Mm-hmm. So I see what you mean in the sense that, like, if it's going to keep happening to someone over and over, they're going to learn from the repetition.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense for Burnham to be learning because she's never resetting aware. It. Yeah, she shouldn't be aware. And it's never explained, like, how she becomes aware in a shorter and shorter period of time.
Vulcan Science Academy,
yeah,
man.
So that's why that, Vulcan that's why training. I think it had to be have involved Stamets more, showing more between Stamets and Burnham to show how she was like learning faster and faster every time because of that
well,
trust.
Well, we talked about it during the commercials though, and to me, I thought it was just obvious that they were skipping all the exposition, which I'm happy that they do.
That's like, kind of the formula of these stories. Yeah. It's like as you get further into the movie or episode, they cut the time.
We see the exposition, so why do we have to keep repeating it again?
They'll
cut the
time period of how much you spend.
The reason is because we have to assume that because otherwise, you know, it doesn't make sense. But that's not just because you say it's happening. It's not convincing unless it's shown. Like what is it that in their relationship that allowed Burnham to trust Stamets more and allow Stamets to trust Burnham.
You mean
more.
With each repetition, like more and more trusting
him
more and more.
You need to show that rather than showing like, you know, oh, okay, I told you to go dance with Tyler and then now you just believe me now.
Right.
I didn't find that believable.
Because you're saying like if he repeats like three times, like why would there be a progression if each time he's saying go dance with him? She's like, no.
I mean, to me, I don't get hung up on those things. It's very obvious. Just like you see enough TV shows and movies, you know, kind of the storytelling conceits,
right?
And kind of work within.
Well, I knew that was the objective, but because I wasn't convinced by the way that they did it.
So you just like essentially just didn't buy into it to a certain degree. Like, and to me, like I did buy into it. Like I totally understand like logically how you could have a problem with these things because I think it. It is a question that might nag at you if you're not kind of being swept up into the episode. And this is very much you're going to get caught into it and kind of swept into it, or you're not. And you're going to kind of stand outside of it and just find it kind of maybe a little annoying or something.
Yeah.
But for me, I just loved spending time with the characters in this episode. And I loved how, you know, we got to see more of Burnham. We got to see Tilly being really fun. We got to see, you know, Stamets talking about how he met his partner, Dr. Culber. And these are like the moments that I've been dying to see throughout this series so far.
And I think part of the issue that we've had with it is just narratively, it's just been so propulsive that we haven't been able to just sit back with the crew. And I like that this is actually our first real diversion episode where it's not all hung.
It's like not a main arc.
Well, yeah. I mean, they do build in the Klingon stuff to a certain degree, but this isn't like Klingon war centric sort of episode.
Yeah,
I mean,
last week there was a little bit of that with the Sarek plotline, but then the B plot of Lorca was very much tied to the Klingon War. So,
well, I would say, by the time you literally have Klingon slashing diplomats in the face, but this, I think we need more diversion episodes like this for Discovery to really kind of maybe capture that spirit of Star Trek that I think Andy's talking about here. Because I
agree.
To me, I'm somebody who's like, Star Trek needs to evolve with the times. Like, there's 700 other episodes that you can go back and watch and just repeat as much as you want. To me, my concern with Discovery is that I don't know if it's evolving Star Trek in a way that kind of reflects how modern television storytelling has changed so much. This, oftentimes, the writing, it seems very kind of on the nose, which is... Mm-hmm. I think Star Trek has been guilty of
what are you talking
being
about,
very
Tyler?
On the nose at points. But to me, this is the first time I'm watching Discovery and I'm like, oh, this can be a fun show. It doesn't have to be super serious. It doesn't have to be the show where I think a lot of fans have been complaining about maybe the characters are unlikable. I honestly, my favorite part about Star Trek Discovery is the characters. I really like the characters at this point. But the fact that we get to breathe with them, get more of that kind of like personal dynamics between them, like this is kind of the Star Trek series that I'd like to watch week to week, as opposed to this Klingon War, which I've complained about because I don't care.
And about... even at the start of this, they're like, the Klingon War has been raging. We've played such a part in so many victories. I'm like, okay.
If you say so. Exactly. It's just all we hear is them like, yeah, well, there's another victory for us.
The and... war of exposition.
But that's just it. Like they said like 10,000 souls have been lost so far. Sure. I'm like, okay.
A lot of ships.
Well, I don't get any sort of sense of scale with regards to this war. And I think that's kind of been like a storytelling failure. Yeah. And maybe it's just production costs of doing space battles. I do not want to watch space battles every single week. That's what we had with Star Trek Voyager. At the end of every episode, it's like there's explosions on the bridge. And I'm just like, okay. But I don't know. Do you guys care about this Klingon War at all, Andy?
I care about it in the sense of I want to know how it ties into the Prime universe, I guess.
Right, like the canon of Star Trek. Yeah. Yeah.
But not in the mechanics of the war itself.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I mean, Cam, what are your thoughts so far?
Really, all I'm liking out of it is that it's brought our characters together.
Yeah.
I like Laurel and Voke. I really like those characters. And Cole, of course. But the war itself, I could care less.
Yeah.
And, you know, it kind of reminds me a little bit of the X-Files return last season. You know, they had like the 6-episode arc, right? And I could have cared less about the mythology that ran through those episodes. But I really liked, like, you know, 2 of the standalones.
Yeah.
And in this case with Discovery, I'm finding some of the episodes that stand a little more on their own are my favorites. And when I look at more of the arc type stories, I'm like, like I don't really care.
I totally agree, and I think we need more episodes like this. This to me kind of shows that they can kind of grasp like what the show should be. I just sense that going forward, they're every season they're gonna go for like this season long arc, and I'm like,
yeah,
okay. I just hope that the arcs is the value of the show season to season going to weigh entirely on like how good the central arc is going to be?
I think so. That for me, yeah. For me, it's got to be that is the payoff. You know, is
yeah.
What I'm seeing right now, it's like this seems like it's written like, you know, week to week.
Like they're kind of making it up as they go along.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's an exaggeration.
Yeah. But, yeah. I think. I don't necessarily get that sense, but to me, I just it's much better if you have the kind of these episodic adventures, which I really like for from Star Trek. Like that's one of the things I think they did well. DS9 had a really good balance.
And I think they wrapped it up very well at the end. I mean, in the last couple episodes, like wrapping up the big entire arc, you know.
Yeah.
I think that was done well.
Well, maybe let's talk a little bit about the mechanics of this episode with kind of the repeating timeline, because as soon as we see the ship explode, we all looked at each other like, we know what this is going to be about. We've seen it before in Star Trek with, I mean, cause and effect is obviously the kind of go-to episode, the touchstone episode when it comes to these kinds of things. We've seen other, you know, time loop episodes before. If you're going to go against a big, big cause and effect like episode, how do you think this one stacks up?
Well, I mean, maybe let Cam go first because I think
you did articulate kind of your problems with the mechanics of this. Cam, what are your thoughts here?
I thought this episode did the really smart thing in that if you're going to make an episode that can really be held up opposite cause and effect, do the opposite and make it comedic. Like, have fun with it, because there's no point approaching it with gravitas, because people are just going to say, you know what, it's just not as good as Cause and Effect, which is an all-time classic TNG episode. I'm sure for most, it's like maybe a top 5 episode.
Yeah.
And so, like, why bother? At least, you know, do the goofier version of it, which this did. It was very light, and it had, like, almost like a romantic comedy type feel to, you know, the Burnham and Ash Tyler stuff, where it was kind of in broad strokes. And, you know, this show has done... It's often felt kind of cumbersome the way it's been establishing the characters in the past handful. But I loved that in this episode, we could have quick snippets of like Lorca, and we know that character. Like, we, you know, it's just fun to see him being toyed with by Mud and stuff like that. You know, we don't need to kind of, we've spent enough time kind of building that character that we can just kind of watch him be goofed around with and, you know, zapped into space. And it's funny.
And let's talk about the Mud factor here.
Yeah.
Listeners know I think it's a really bad decision on the part of the writers to bring back Mud. He's here to stay. I guess I have to go with it at this point. Rainn Wilson, whatever you want to call this character, you know, like he's met Mud.
Yeah.
he's a great character. The character that Rainn Wilson here is playing, this pre-TOS era Mud, the presumably non sex trafficker Mud. I'm enjoying this. You know, like this was a fun kind of sort of a medium for Mud to jump into, do this time loop. I can believe a villain is out there like this, just trying to get his revenge and make some money on the side. And he seems as if he's actually got some smarts about him. Like he can actually repeat it, figure out how the ship works to the point where it's calling it cap. The ship's calling him captain.
Yeah.
This is fun. And I like how this Rainn Wilson character is working. I don't have much hopes that the writers are ever going to reconcile the fact that this guy's a sex trafficker. He's always going to be kind of like this rascally rogue, but yeah. I guess I just have to go with that at this point. What do you figure about the Mud that we've seen so far, Andy?
I find it kind of, inconsistent of how he's being portrayed. Like,
what are you talking about, Andy?
Well, because he seems very technically competent. Being able
like
to...
Jonathan Frakes is directing. Technically competent.
Well, I mean, he takes over the entire ship. He's got a plan to, you know, he's learning from his these iterations. But for some reason, in the end, he's kind of like fooled by some kind of stupid trick.
So more with like maybe the episode I, Mud of the original series,
yeah.
Where he is tricking the crew.
Yeah,
like he did trick them all, but they ended up, you know, getting one over on him in the end.
Yeah,
like,
he tricked them far more than they tricked him.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, so that's it. I mean, in this series, it didn't really make sense to me. Like, he has total control over the ship. Why does he need to, you know, really get all this, you know, the secret knowledge of the drive when he's basically control the ship? Okay, kill the crew and then sell the ship.
Why does he need to get?
Yeah, like, why can't he just? He has full control of the ship, right?
Yeah.
And why does he need to? Why can't?
Well, because he went there to figure out why the ship is so special, but he couldn't figure out how to operate the spore drive. So that's why he kept repeating this time loop, is trying to figure out the spore drive. The big factor, and the Discovery crew couldn't figure it out for the longest time either. For like, what, 6.5 months until they finally figure out the tardigrade thing. So he had no idea that Stamets actually fit into the picture. He had to be essentially kind of the biological supercomputer that would make the spore drive go.
And the Klingons have tasked him to do, like, out of all the people, you know, with all the resources that the Klingons have, they tasked this guy.
I don't
guy
think they
to
have
do.
Tasked him, though. I think he's trying to sell it to them.
Yeah.
He's figured out what
not,
it is.
They're not aware. Like, there's no kind of, like,
I don't think they have a clue.
No.
He's contacted them to sell them the ship because like, he's even, saying this
not,
has a spore drive.
Not until after he's obtained control of the ship. Then that's the first contact he makes with the Klingons. I don't know.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
It just didn't. I don't know. I guess like the original Harvey or
Harcourt.
Harcourt Fenton Mud.
Yeah.
I mean, I did get that kind of like he's kind of. Like a con man, and he's smart, but he also has his flaws. I mean, I guess
yes,
that,
he's a sex trafficker.
I guess if that character could exist in this universe, yeah. But I don't find him consistent in the in this universe. I guess maybe.
Okay.
What do you mean by consistent, though?
A character how a character like that could exist in the Star Trek Discovery universe. I can see how it can exist in the TOS universe, like the
right.
production universe.
How much of that has to do with the tone of the episodes he appears in, too, in that
well,
in TOS?
Because I think TOS did have a lot more of that kind of swashbuckling kind of feel to it. So I don't think it took itself as seriously as... Like,
especially not the Mud episodes.
Yeah.
So if this is maybe the introduction of Mud as opposed to the, what, was it 2 episodes ago? Or maybe 3 episodes ago that we got him, like, would that have fit in better as his introduction to this universe?
I think it's because the Star Trek Discovery universe is not as lighthearted.
No, that's true.
So I don't think the character fits into this, like, universe at all.
But I don't know, like, you go through...
Like, let's go to
Star Trek Next Generation, where every week it's a different sort of tone. There's a different sort of...
Would Mud have fit on that show, do you think?
this Rainn Wilson character.
Yeah.
He's very much kind of like Berlinhoff Rasmussen.
Yes.
Who, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. But at least Rasmussen, I think he was consistent, like in universe consistent. Like, I mean, he didn't do anything that didn't make sense.
But what didn't make sense with this, though?
Well, I how come Harvey Mudd has his personal shield, and how could he let his guard down so that... How did he let his guard down so that...
I always figured, like, Harry Mudd is one step away from a genius. He comes up with all the plans that should work, but he always has that little fallacy that he's just not quite... He can't focus enough to really cover all of his bases, but he's close. You know, he's always close to conning the Star Trek crew.
Well, like not losing his personal shield or whatever. That doesn't seem like a... That's not really a missed mistake. That's just being an idiot.
Yeah, but that's the thing. Isn't he kind of an idiot? Like, he's like a genius who's also kind of an idiot. He kind of vacillates between the two. And so that's the thing. He'll always trick them. But the way they will get him in return...
It should have been a trick. It should have been a trick that they got him. Like, maybe they trick him into lowering a shield or something like that. Rather than, I forgot to lower... I somehow turned my back and then someone grabbed my gun.
Or is he just a character that the second he sort of has the upper hand, he just scatters? Uh-huh. Like, that's when he's the most fallible, is when he has the upper hand.
Yeah. He figured, I've got the deal sealed. As far as he was concerned, the Klingons were about to beam aboard. I've got, what can the Discovery crew really do? He already made the deal with Lorca. As far as he knew, like, Lorca was going to save the crew in order to, you know, make this deal happen.
Yeah.
So I can see that. I can see that he's screwed up the deal, but I don't see how he could lose his, you know, personal control over his safety.
I find this fascinating. You know, we had you on to talk about the episode Gambit from TNG, and which was a very lighthearted kind of fun episode. And in that case,
I love
that
episode. Yeah.
You loved it, and I was the one who was like, "This is idiotic." And I just think it's so funny that you know, it's kind of a similarly lighthearted episode, but it's the opposite dynamic where, like, I'm like, "Oh, this was a blast," and you're like, "None of this works for me.
Doesn't make sense."
It's
interesting. Do you just think that maybe Discovery is not the show for you? Like, could you ever picture yourself coming around to Discovery? Or, because, I mean, I just wonder if, fundamentally, this is just not the right show for you.
I think that,
I have my issues with the series. Mm-hmm. But to me, like, a lot of it is, like, I can just go with it.
I have
you
to,
know?
I think, I'm just going to keep watching it.
Yeah.
I would say that it has to change for me to get into it.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah. It's got to make more sense on the science fiction side.
Right.
For me to really get drawn into it.
Okay.
And capture my attention. Definitely is not the episode that is trying to make sense, really. This to me felt very original series where the tech stuff is just like, whatever.
I don't care how this works.
Dismiss it in a sentence, sort of thing.
There's space whales and time crystals.
Yeah. Galaxy's Child.
Yeah. Totally. But to me, that's like... so frequently kind of one of the tropes of Star Trek. It's kind of like they brush over the science and you're like, okay, you know, it's just a way to tell like a fun story or an interesting story. And I found this to be an engaging kind of look into these characters. Like, to me, this is so much more of a character story as opposed to like kind of a plot driven story, which is why I really like this one, though.
I mean, I could have seen this as a character driven story, but it's got to be about Stamets. It's got to be about Stamets. It's got to be about Stamets and Burnham. If Burnham is your main character, make it about Stamets and Burnham. But Stamets has got to play a bigger role.
Haven't we already seen that a million times before, though?
I don't think it's the same because, like, say in Cause and Effect, that story was not about Data. I would say it's not really about it's more about the.
Well, that was more of an ensemble episode. Yeah.
But yeah, so I think this episode should have been about Stamets versus Mudd.
Okay.
Or it should have been like, you know, a push and pull between with, you know, Stamets as the good guy and then Mudd as the bad guy, and they you know, they're battling each other through this through each repetition. Or it should have been something like if Burnham is the main character, then it's got to be about Stamets and Burnham's relationship.
I mean, I would
that would have done it for me.
Right.
And I would have been able to, I think, you know, do you forgive think, all of those that you
do
know,
you think going forward Stamets and Burnham have developed another level of trust that they did not possess prior to this episode.
Well, I mean, the writers could always write it as if it was, but I don't think they did an effective job of showing it in this episode.
But what about her telling him the secret, you know, that she's never been in love?
Yeah.
You know, he now has information on her that no other crew member has.
And it comes to a point by the end of the episode that she has enough trust in him that they go forward with this plan, and within 30 minutes they... foil mud.
And he is the one, you know, I love that sequence where he's like teaching her to dance out in the hallway. Yeah. Like, what a great scene. But, you know, he's the one who's giving her advice and kind of pushing her towards Tyler, or Ash Tyler. I don't want to confuse the two, but,
you wish.
But, you know, previous to this episode, I think he would have automatically said Tilly's going to play that role. Like, there would be no, the role of kind of, you know.
Humanizing her.
Yeah, and matchmaking Michael Burnham
who
would have
thought,
Tyler.
In episode 3, Stamets would have been the one teaching Burnham how to love.
Yeah, and I love that it doesn't, like, at least to me, it doesn't feel rushed getting here.
Yeah.
It's, you know, been 7 episodes, and it feels like it's earned. It doesn't feel like we're going crazy, like rushing from, you know, post to post, basically trying to get these characters in place for wherever they're going by the end of the arc.
So maybe we'll dive into it a little in a few minutes when we get to the Ortonville report.
Yes.
But,
I wanted to just say, sorry, one thing about Harry Mudd.
I'll just finish what I'm saying here, though. But, like, one of the things that I hate about television is when I can predict every single thing that's going to happen, which I find with the Orville nonstop.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know what was going to happen next with this episode, and that's what I really liked about it, though. And it worked for me, and like from the storytelling level, you know, it didn't seem as if like kind of a total retreat on like all the other kinds of cause and effect episodes that we saw before. And the character stuff, it all worked for me and it all made sense. But you're going to say about Harry Mudd.
Yeah, I never gave my take before. I thought it was really interesting in that Harry Mudd is a character so well established by the original series. You know, a lot of fans, you know, when they're cosplaying, they're dressing up as original series Harry Mudd. As far as I'm concerned, the two best Harry Mudd stories I've seen are in Discovery. By a considerable long shot.
Yeah, I agree. Because, I mean, A is a pretty stupid character in the original series.
Well,
and then,
I don't know that the character is stupid. He's like...
I guess what I'm saying is the writers celebrating his behavior is stupid. In that he's a sex trafficker, but you gotta just love that guy. Isn't he like a little rascal?
Yeah, well, they're just dopey episodes. Like, you know, when you look at the goofy episodes of the original series, people don't talk about those. They talk about like Tribbles or a piece of the action. No one's like, oh yeah, that I Mud was a hoot.
No.
You know, it's like, whatever, it was forgettable. So I really like the use of this character. And I thought it's interesting how they're kind of alluding to like Q with this character, where he refers to Lorca as like Mon Capitan.
Oh, right.
And I was like, oh, but there was also allusions to the Joker in the episode title alone. Probably in the comics, I'd say the most famous quote from the Joker is saying, all it takes is one bad day to make the sanest man go mad. And, you know, this episode is called Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad.
Okay.
You know, and so it's like, okay. And there's a point where Harry Mudd comes onto the bridge and he says to Lorca, where do you get those wonderful toys? Or something along those lines.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa, like they're really hammering home this Joker comparison as well. Like they are really playing up Harry Mudd as this trickster figure who has a lot of power in this universe.
Is he at this point going to be Lorca's primary kind of antagonist sort of character?
Lorca's? Yeah. Well, I don't know about Lorca's, but Michael Burnham's maybe. Who knows how long Lorca's around?
I'd like to see... written as Burnham's antagonist, because I think what we saw in the last episode is that this guy's got a little bit of a psycho, right?
But he's his issue though is with Lorca.
Yes, but how long is Lorca on this series?
No, but that's why I brought up you were bringing up the Joker v Batman,
right?
Yeah. And I think that's more kind of Lorca would be the Batman in this scenario.
So far, for sure.
Yeah. So that's why, and the whole reason he came and started targeting the ship was because of Lorca.
Yeah.
You know, Lorca was kind of his the way that we're introduced to the character a few episodes back is through Lorca. So that's why I think, you know, we can debate whether or not Lorca's sticking around for the long run, but I think he's, I don't think this is going to be the last time we see Mudd this season.
Right.
If it is, I'm positive he'll be back in future episodes, and I don't know. Yeah, maybe Burnham will get a handful of that guy.
I mean, is this a character they're going to kind of co-opt as a main sort of adversary of their series, kind of like Voyager did with the Borg?
No.
You don't think so?
Not as a main adversary.
Not as a main, but like as a standby character they're going to constantly bring back and kind of make their own?
No, I think it'd be like maybe once a season we get an appearance. Kind of like,
right.
More like Q, where like once a season we get a Q episode.
And right.
I think we get something like that.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think, Andy? More. Do you think there are more Mud appearances on the horizon?
I think it's going to be more like you described.
A season sort of deal?
Or hopefully even less.
But it is kind of an ownership thing, because if Mud's only in two episodes of the original series, whereas we're already at two for Discovery,
right.
If we're going forward and they do four or five, it's kind of like they kind of take ownership of that character.
Kind of like with Voyager, and we had, 22 Borg episodes on Voyager versus 8 or 9 on Next Gen?
That's sort of where my kind of comparison was coming from, whereas, you know, really outnumbering the number of episodes, the point where people in many ways associate that character, race, or whatever, more with that series because it played such a bigger role.
Yeah.
I think if he appears more, he's got to have a bigger importance to the main arc.
I think he works here because it's a diversion episode.
And he is a trickster figure.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of like saying, you know, should Q have a role in a major arc on, you know, Next Generation? Not really, because he has too much power over it, or he's too much of a wild card.
I don't want to see a season two arc that hangs all on Harry Mudd.
What they've done, though, is they've made Harry Mudd into this actually very powerful character.
Yeah, so far.
Right? And I mean, how are they going
to... Well, he doesn't have the time crystal anymore, so...
But he was powerful enough in the sense that he obtained the... He was able to, like, resourceful enough, he can obtain this thing that can take over the whole ship, destroy the whole ship. And then now, if they keep putting him in here, they're going to explain... How are they going to explain, like, because he's got this super powerful character, and, like, how are these just diversions? You know, like, what's the point of having these diversion episodes where they have this super powerful character and in the end, we defeated this, you know, god figure.
But isn't that kind of like Q episodes?
I think the Q episodes were more, they're character development episodes, right? The reason that they wrapped it up is because Q decided, you know, okay, I'm letting these guys go, or like there's some sort of the human, like, lesson learned,
right?
And then the episode ended. It's not like, oh, we found this thing to defeat Q and then we defeated him this time, but until next time,
right?
You know, that's, okay. It's not like that, right?
Well, yeah, and you are right in the sense, like, the Q episodes, there would be some kind of trifle episodes with him, but they were usually the weakest, but they would also use him in very powerful episodes like Tapestry or Encounter at Farpoint, or you know, All Good Things. Whereas I don't know that I would quite expect a Harry Mudd Tapestry type episode.
No, not at all. Yeah. I just picture it more of like, hey, I'm back, guys, and I'm going to make you, I don't know, fight over this Gorn skeleton, or I don't know, just like something silly. It's going to be like a lighter episode. I think that's why, look, if you're going to do kind of a lighter episode, I think Mudd is probably the character that's going to keep coming back.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that definitely works. I'm just curious if there's any other like fun moments in this episode that stood out to you guys.
I did like just kind of the relationship that we have with Hugh and with Paul, and just kind of more of that. It's nice to see kind of like a normal relationship on Star Trek, as opposed to kind of the stiff sort of like...
I don't know what you're talking about, Tyler. Well, stiff relationships on Star Trek.
No, but you know, the only other normal one we've really seen, though, was Ben and Cassidy. Because even, like, O'Brien and Keiko really did not like each other that
right.
much. Like, they were pretty stiff.
And the B'Elanna-Tom one was definitely pretty wacky.
I know
to
the
start.
Fans like that, but those actors just didn't really have much chemistry with each other.
Well, Robert Duncan McNeil talked about that in San Francisco.
Yeah, I kind of compared it to...
And they were,
to...
like, really good friends, so it was kind of like brother-sister when they were doing those episodes.
Yes, which is kind of... You can see why maybe their chemistry wasn't...
Yeah,
really there.
And when you look at other relationships, you know, the T'Pol and Trip one is kind of, it's pretty problematic and weird.
Yeah, but I guess I like elements of that relationship, and that it creates conflict within them, and it's actually conflict that I buy.
But think of how it started, Tyler.
I know, I know.
Vulcan neuropressure scenes, and it's like the Red Shoe Diaries.
Yeah. So, but I mean, this, I kind of buy it as like two characters that are just like normal people, but on maybe different sides of the spectrum of personality, and to me, this relationship's working for me.
You know, a moment that I loved in this episode was like Lorca as the indifferent captain. When this, this, you know, space whale is you know, in space.
Gormagander.
Yes, and they're talking about what to do about it. And
sorry, where's the space whale?
It's out in space.
Oh, okay. And,
but they're like debating back and forth what to do with it. Lorca could not care less.
No.
Like this, I just love the idea of a captain who's just like, ugh, whatever.
He's like, I don't give a damn. Did that make you think of the Trouble with Tribbles with Kirk having to deal with like all the grain?
Right.
He's like, really? Ugh. Okay, guys, I got the grain.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, no, he just kept saying, still don't give a damn. That's
get
pretty good. Yeah, that's a pretty good Lorca line. Could that be his new Make It So?
That would be amazing.
I don't give a damn.
Does Lorca make sense in this universe as a captain of a Starfleet ship?
I would say, I was thinking about this today, in fact, in that we've seen enough bad captains throughout Starfleet. This is the first time that we get like a main character who is the bad captain. We have the crew underneath him. So I think that's kind of an interesting thing. It's very clear that they're not celebrating Lorca's behavior.
Yeah.
They're making you really question this guy. So I think, yes, he does work in this universe. It's just we haven't experienced this in one of as kind of the captain leading a series before.
The show definitely isn't reverent towards him.
No. Yeah. No, whereas, you know, like, think about somebody like Benjamin Maxwell.
Yeah.
Who was the captain and, I believe, the wounded. And
right.
We also have Admiral Pressman, for example.
Jellicoe.
Well, Jellicoe was actually shown to be petty, but very
competent. But not sort of that.
He was very flawed.
He was not like that inspirational Star Trek character we should strive towards.
Who was the captain of the Pegasus?
Pressman, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's the guy who I'm seeing the most in.
And I would say so. And like, so we know that those kinds of captains exist out there. So for people to like, because we've seen it on the message boards, like, this is against the memory of Gene Roddenberry.
That's
like,
Andy.
I know.
I would say that I can see this captain existing in the universe.
Yeah. So it's unique in that we've never had a series where we've actually been underneath a captain in this situation. So
that's why I think there's potential here for the writers to make him the main antagonist for Burnham. Actually, I think that could be something that could make it more like Star Trek, more Gene Roddenberry like, because I think one of the central ideas is that, you know, humanity is now like an ethical species, and when these kind of things happen, these kind of people still exist in this universe, but there's some sort of I don't know, mechanism within humanity to that these people these people are still, you know, discovered and they're replaced and with good people.
There are bad apples in every batch, right? So, and I think this is really just kind of an examination of one of those bad apples.
And he's a very pessimistic character. And Star Trek's all about optimism.
Yeah.
So.
He stands out. And you said it, Cam, like, they're not being reverent towards Lorca. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the key here. So, yeah.
And I think one thing that's interesting is that I think the audience knows more about Lorca than the crew, because we've seen kind of him in his, like, the audience sees stuff that the rest of the crew doesn't see.
Yeah.
And we see how he's behaved
in the bedroom.
Yeah. Well, first of all, sleeping with, you know, people in his chain of command.
Yeah.
And then secondly,
Admiral
Cornwell.
Yeah, but he wasn't sleeping with like somebody beneath him in his chain of command, though.
Well, that's true, but still being in, like,
with a senior officer.
Yeah, senior officer. That's still a problem for him, though. I think, like, in terms of painting him as, you know, a leader, you know, you can't do that and still be an ethical leader. And then secondly, you know, obvious, I think the insight into how he's kind of, like, becoming very kind of paranoid, sleeping with a phaser. And then also...
I don't want to know more about sleeping with a phaser versus an admiral. Wow.
sounds not
painful.
Basically, you know, not rescuing the admiral, even though he would have done that in the past.
No. He's following the rules. Andy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I think the implication is that he's willing to do this for to save his career.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah. And
I think,
his command. Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, and then the other thing, even the reasons for him saying, he said, please don't take this ship away from me. It's all I've got.
Yeah.
Right? It's about him.
Right.
It's not about Starfleet. It's not about the ship. It's not about his crew. It's about him.
Do you think he was a fundamentally flawed character before the loss of the Bran, like his first or his previous command? Or do you think that maybe push him over to the edge? Or do you think like that actually was, he was a totally normal commander, but that just cracked him, that experience of having to give up his entire crew and his ship?
I think
give up as in like destroy.
Yeah, I think that I'll have to review it because I don't think I've seen it, watched it enough closely enough, but I would think that it's actually, that's his core personality.
Okay.
And he's been hiding it.
And so maybe
I think that could be the whole central tension for this whole arc. He's been hiding that. When is Burnham going to discover that? And Burnham's going to be able to take, like, prove herself or whatever.
Do you think this was something buried within him before the Bran, and the Bran pushed him over the edge? Yeah. Or because I would argue that the Admiral, Cornwall, she was a psychiatrist, right? And so she said that something changed within him after the destruction of Bran.
I do think it was always there, because this is a character who we found, discovered, has always been like collecting like weapons of war and things like that. Like, there's a dark side to this guy.
Has he?
I think so. I don't think that was just since since his other ship went down.
Then where was he keeping these items?
I don't know. Well, this whole bridge is filled with them. So
yeah, but I mean, if the Bran's been
destroyed,
do you
think he just picked up that hobby after that happened?
Well, that's why I'm saying maybe this pushed him over the edge, though, because like
I think he was always into this, and that pushed him
but
over the brink.
If he has all these things that he's keeping on his ship, and his previous ship was destroyed, where did he get all these things now?
His collection at home.
Okay, so it's his home collection.
He had them in storage.
Sure. Okay. I don't know. Maybe.
He lost some other skeletons, like the Mugatu skeleton was in the other ship.
Yeah. So so you guys both think like this is kind of like a pre-Bran thing. Like,
he does not strike me as like the idyllic captain broken by this one instance.
I would say the argument that you could make is that he was the one who is willing to destroy his ship and the crew along with it as he makes his escape. So maybe that already tells you enough that he was kind of already willing to go that far.
Also, you know? I think if this series were about him, I could see him being written as, you know, he was a fall from grace kind of character. But as I think it seems like the series is about Burnham, then her foil is going to be a guy that's much more kind of like straightforward. A guy who's always been like that. It's just that nobody's discovered it yet.
Yeah, because I look at like a character like Sisko, who is a captain that often danced into the gray. Sisko was never a character who would have sacrificed his entire team.
And also, Sisko has guilt.
Yes. Yeah, like, Lorca doesn't strike me as being torn up about these people he lost.
I just feel like we need like a Lorca flashback episode, though. Yeah. Like, I want to see him aboard his old ship with his crew. I'm still confused about how Landry fits into the picture, because remember he said last week that he and Landry have been through like thick and thin and all that?
Yeah.
She somehow wasn't part of his previous crew, though. I don't know. It was very confusing to me. But and I was it really just 6 months of them serving together that convinced him that this was his go-to kind of right-hand woman?
He spent a few days with Tyler, and then now he's convinced that it was able to convince him to put him in charge of the entire ship.
That's true. That's a very good point.
Maybe he's just, I got a feeling about this.
Well, let's talk about Ash Tyler, because we'd talked in previous episodes of the podcast that this character was kind of a blank.
Yeah.
How did you guys feel about Ash Tyler at the end of this episode, which spent a lot of time with him?
Still doesn't have as much personality as the other characters, but part of it is we've only had a few episodes with him, but he's still not as distinct. He seems like a nice guy, very charismatic. People dig him.
Very charismatic?
To the crew.
Or mildly charismatic.
He's just tall and dark.
Is that it? Yeah, people keep calling him intriguing.
Oh, I'd fall into his arms too. You know, I'd be like, he is intriguing.
Yeah.
But, I mean...
I would say he's a step above the bland hunk that we often see cast in these roles.
Like your favorite character
Max
on the show?
Max Richter?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it Max Richter?
Or no, so Milton Richter.
Milton Richter.
Yeah. So why was Milton not at his communications post? Instead, he was replaced by what Harry Mudd called the random communications officer man.
That was great.
that was a great line. Yeah.
I thought for sure he was going to die. Right
red shirt.
Yeah. Was Richter just hanging out in the party too?
He was making out with Kayla.
Oh, that was Milton.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I missed that. I've noticed Kayla like. Yeah. Okay.
Wait, which one's is Kayla? The one with the...
She's like kind of seven of nine looking.
Yeah. I think she could be a very interesting character
if they gave her something to say.
Maybe if they gave her like a line.
She
she was featured in the scene, but they didn't even give her a line.
They've let her say I in previous episodes. Yeah. Why aren't they giving her any lines to say?
I don't
know,
because she was on the Shenzo, which seems like that would carry a lot of weight, that character coming onto Discovery, where you also have Burnham.
Yeah.
She doesn't seem to have much of an opinion
on it.
Well,
I mean, there's the opportunity to have some sort of conflict with Burnham, but right now they've kind of just separated them.
Yeah.
And then it's like, there's nothing to see here. Well, but I think that'd be very interesting to see how she would. I mean, I think they've implied that Kayla has some sort of, animosity.
Well, she's got cybernetic implants now.
Yeah. She's a superhuman, So. I mean, but let's explore that.
Yeah, I agree.
I'll explore how do people in the future handle that kind of thing.
Yeah, because she's kind of the...
She went to the same therapist as Lorca.
She's like the Tracy Coco of the show at this point. Like, sure. She's more of like just the side background character that you're like, okay, whatever.
For those who may not know the name Tracy Coco.
What are you talking about, Tyler? They all know.
She's a very notable background actor on Star Trek The Next Generation. A woman with short hair. I think most often we saw her in the gold kind of operations colors in the bridge.
She was in a couple of the movies too.
Yeah. So, okay. Hey, guys, can we talk a little bit about... The threat ganglia, why was it not expanding throughout these time loops?
Excellent question.
Is there a flaw with the threat ganglia? Is this kind of like Troy's,
I feel something.
Yeah, empathic powers that somehow would turn off and not pick up these bad dudes?
Well,
I don't know.
You didn't see they were going off every time Burnham walked into the room.
Ah, okay.
That was the distraction.
He's become desensitized.
Okay.
When you serve under Lorca, the ganglia go up all the time, so you just begin to ignore them.
Like the
this
space...
is a higher, stronger and stronger stimulation required.
Okay. But I was just thinking, when the space whale appeared, would not his threat ganglia go up knowing that there's this dude hiding inside its gut?
He didn't know that.
No, but the threat ganglia, it's kind of like this subconscious sort of thing.
It's like the Spidey sense.
I mean, his subconscious could not have known that either, right?
But there's been other moments where... recall when in episode 3 when the shuttle took off from the ship that held all the prisoners and his threat ganglia went up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because Burnham wasn't on the shuttle. How could he have known that, though?
Mm-hmm. And it's also gone off right before she entered a room.
Yeah.
So it is like the Spidey sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't understand the science behind how this works.
I'm okay that it was consistent. It didn't go off the first time, and it shouldn't. And it didn't go off.
Harry Mudd would walk into a room, and there's and no threat ganglia. Nope.
Maybe the twist is that Saru and Harry Mudd are best friends.
I buy that.
Yeah.
Would you watch their let's say the next Harry Mudd appearance is maybe a bit of a road trip episode of Saru and Mudd. Would you buy that? Would that be a fun
trapped in the shuttlecraft?
Yeah,
that's about. Then marooned on the planet.
It's an only a matter of time, isn't it, till we have an episode where a character is stranded with Harry Mudd somewhere.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
It would be another...
Enemy mine.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Guys, what do you make of... I can't believe I did not mention it, but the space helmet that Harry Mudd was introduced in. I love that.
The Donnie Darko rabbit hat?
Yeah.
Yeah.
With the antennae and everything.
Yeah. It was very 1950s sci-fi magazine.
It was kind of a fun little throwback in that I could actually buy something that silly in this universe, but it was right on the edge where I'm just if they added one more little accoutrement to it, I was it would have made it too silly, but this, I don't know, it was fun.
I actually think that uniform does a really good job setting up the tone of the episode.
Yes.
When a character walks out in that, you instantly kind of look at his lighter. This is not the Borg invading the ship. It's something kind of goofy looking.
No.
And so right from there, I think it really sets the energy from everything that's going to go forward. I was just curious from you two, though. How did you feel about the resolution of this episode with Harry Mudd's beloved Stella coming with her father?
Okay, I really didn't like this, though.
Yeah.
I thought it was kind of dumb, in that, they're still paying dowries in the 23rd century. Does that make any sense at all?
We've heard kind of weird things like this in the past in Star Trek, where there's these societies that have very, very old-fashioned, almost Earth-like customs.
They're just not mainstream society.
Yeah.
Okay, I think that's fine. I'm okay with the ending. I think it's consistent with
It's consistent with Harry Mudd episodes.
Yeah, Harry Mudd episodes. It's
are the Baron and his daughter just that dumb that they want to take him back?
Yes.
Well, it's not. I mean, it's to me, it's the daughter that's dumb, and the Baron's just like, I want everything for my daughter.
Okay.
And that's believable to me.
To me, it's hard to kind of empathize with like dumb characters though. And like it, like yeah. It's like this civilian woman, it doesn't really reflect on her very well.
Well, I was wondering if there's going to be a twist where, because she says, I know who you really are, Harry. And I'm thinking, oh, this is the twist of her being like,
yeah,
you know,
or we reveal she's the one who wears the pants.
Yeah.
Or
well, you know, and.
But it doesn't really seem that way.
In the episode I, Mud, where they reveal his wife does wear the pants. She's the one who's always like ordering them around.
Oh, yeah. She froze her in the
yeah,
thing, right?
Yeah.
But this that wasn't Stella, right?
I don't know. It might be.
Okay.
I mean, it could be. It very well could be. I was thinking that the whole time. They both were brunettes. I can say that.
Did we not learn his name or her name in I, Mud?
I can't remember. Okay. I don't think so, but is she maybe?
Okay. Interesting. What did I did...
It's not an episode I rewatch a lot. I've watched it twice in my lifetime.
Yeah. I did dig the Baron's cape. I think more sci-fi needs capes.
Right.
And I thought this is a cool look, you know, kind of the leather cape plus tie.
I think there needs to be a podcast on best capes.
You know, there was that NBC show called The Cape. You know,
right.
That could have been, yeah.
I will say this about the kind of the finale with the Baron and the daughter. I like that those two characters look like they stepped out of an original series episode.
Yeah, you know what? Okay, I've kind of been like on the fence with some of the costume designs. In
right.
That. Like, I like the uniforms. But beyond that, we've seen kind of this stuff that doesn't seem as colorful and as bright as I'd like to see from a Star Trek series. And these are my favorite costumes so far that we've seen beyond the uniforms at this point. The Klingon stuff just seems a little too, I don't know, like rigid and alien, or just not as welcoming, or like not as of a great throwback to, say, the 1960s. This was totally emulating like something we would see from the costumes in the original series were fantastic.
Yeah, and very like bright colored.
Yeah. And so I really dug the costumes that we saw here.
Like the father character, the Baron, he looked like an actor they'd like CG'd in from an old Star Trek episode. Like old
like
people
Grand Moff Tarkin sort of style.
People don't really look like that anymore, and yet they found a guy who somehow looks like an older man from the 1960s.
Yeah, yeah.
I loved it.
Okay, I dig as well.
And it was just as goofy and silly as you would see some of those types of characters in the original series.
So, guys, before we get to the Ortonville report, though, any final thoughts on this episode, Andy? You hate it. We get that so much, but I don't know.
It's the anti-Gambit.
Yeah. What's it going to take next week for you to, you know, what do you think is going to make for a better kind of adventure next week instead? What's
like
the Star Trek
I guess,
you want to see?
I want to see something that pushes the characters to the end of the arc. Like, I mean, whatever the, you know, the conclusion of the arc is, or reveals something more about what's going on in terms of how did the Klingons.
Right. So you're more interested in the arc storytelling.
I think so, because I mean,
you're not digging the characters so much.
I'm finding the characters, the relationships, the way they're being written, isn't making sense to me.
See, mm-hmm. I think it's been the strongest part of the show.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of disagreements here. It's very interesting. Yeah, for me, I mean, this was a really fun standalone episode, and I was kind of bummed so far that we aren't getting a lot of standalone episodes.
Yeah.
I hope we do have more, maybe next season. Rod Roddenberry at, I think it was this year's con, kind of a fan was very concerned and asked him if there would be the classic standalone Trek episodes that, you know, we all love from, you know, like TNG or TOS. And he was kind of like, well, there will be a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, he did not give a really confident, like, don't you worry. It was very much like...
Well, which made me worry when I heard him say that. And I was like,
yeah,
really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I hope that, you know, fans maybe embrace this episode and kind of send the message that we would like to see a little more of this next season.
My big concern, though, is like a lot of fans are going to get hung up on this party. I think most fans are really going to complain about this party, and they're just going to keep complaining about that. And I'm just like, oh, guys, like this is a fun episode. Like, focus on like what worked in this. And I thought this episode works for me, and I want more stuff like this.
Yeah.
I think I'm okay with more standalone episodes. It's just that they should develop the characters. Even if they're not going to be developing the arc, I want to see more character development. That makes sense to me.
Yeah, very much so.
Okay.
Before we move to the Ortonville report, though, I would like to just make an apology to the estate of Jane Wyatt. Last week, we talked about the episode Lethe, and I credited the actress who played Spock's mother in Journey to Babel as Jane Wyman, who was another classic Hollywood actress of the same era. It's actually Jane Wyatt. So, well, on the way home, I suddenly had that, you know, that click in my head where I went, uh-oh. Because you followed suit. As soon as I said Jane Wyman, then you began to sing Jane Wyman, too.
I, you know what? I'm sure we'll be forgiven. You know, don't sue us, people. Okay.
So, yes, let's, Tyler.
I always preface this. I'm watching season one of The Orville. I'm watching it more out of curiosity than anything else because there's so many behind-the-scenes people with Star Trek involved, as well as it's an overt homage to Star Trek, especially Star Trek The Next Generation, from the mind of Seth MacFarlane. I mentioned last week that the episode Krill was probably their strongest episode to date, and it was a very hard sci-fi sort of... Well, not a hard sci-fi press, not at all.
It was the cause and effect
it,
of
it
The Orville.
It was more like a storytelling conceit that we've seen before, and that they did it in a way that I thought kind of worked on a sliding scale in terms of The Orville. This most recent episode is Majority Rule, the episode title, and it's really a commentary on social media, and they go to a planet that looks almost exactly like 21st century Earth, and social media, you upvote and downvote people, and if they get enough downvotes, then they are sent through this machine that scrambles their brains for some reason.
Oh, okay.
And I thought it was just a slog. Just like the characters are stupid. Like in this episode, you know how like in some shows and movies, characters act stupid to further the plot. We get this. We get, I just predicted everything that was going on. I don't know this. The other issue is like it's fundamentally one of those episodes that's kind of like we'd see in Star Trek where they go to an alien planet and you see, oh, this is a stupid alien planet. We're far superior to them. I hope these stupid aliens figure it out.
Right.
You know, it's just kind of like, is that's one of the bad tropes of Star Trek that I never really liked. And so we get an entire episode devoted to this and they're trying to give you a sense of wonder by taking one of these aliens up to the ship. Again, they're not a technologically advanced society, so this barista got to go aboard the Orville for some reason that wasn't really clear. She was a barista, but she could give them some insights into their society. I don't know. This is probably my least favorite episode at this point, and I don't think Seth MacFarlane quite grasps what makes Star Trek strong when it was strong. I think he's just kind of doing like his own versions of Star Trek. And I think the problem was this is another episode penned by Seth MacFarlane. He's done all but one episode. And I think the writer's room just doesn't have the heart to tell him like, oh, that's not a great storytelling idea there. And so I know I've said it before. This is not a show for me at all. I'll continue to watch season one. If you like the show, I get it. I think this is like a comfort food sort of show for a lot of Star Trek fans that are yearning for, you know, 90s sort of television. And I don't know. It gives me hope that maybe the previous episode, it had some semblance of getting it right. But we go back to really, really bad, really bad episode here. Like just utterly painful to watch. Andy, have you been watching The Orville at all?
No, I don't even know what it is.
Yeah, it's don't bother. It's okay.
Sounds good.
No, well, no offense to any listeners who are really digging it. I get why you like it. It's just not the show for me, but I'm forcing myself to watch it just at least season one. I won't be back for season two. I'm positive about
that. At least
that.
At this point.
Look, if they blow me away with the
if
finale,
they hit you with like the best of both worlds, at the
I
end
know.
Of the season
I'll,
one.
I'm coming back, but I just don't think he MacFarlane quite gets what makes Star Trek great. It's you know, one of the reviewers said it's MacFarlane doing cosplay, and it kind of feels like a fan film to a certain degree. Cam, you and I, we watched a lot of fan films maybe a year
Tons.
And a half ago, and
all the time
it was for an episode. Yeah, we're doing research for the podcast, and we're like a lot of it was just like tons of exposition because like fans love kind of diving into the universe, but it's not actually good storytelling. It's just like,
well, it tends to be too, they're looking backwards.
Yeah.
Yeah. And whereas like, you know, you can look at like this week's episode of Discovery, which is, you know, looking back at least in terms of its sort of concept, but it feels unlike any Star Trek episode we've seen in terms of sort of the storytelling itself.
Like the execution.
Yeah, the execution. And so I think that's, you know, I can't speak to the Orville, or well, I can to the pilot, yeah. But it felt like we're looking back at 90s, you know, TNG and being like, how do we do that?
Well, see, I thought the pilot was probably the second best episode at this point. Mm-hmm. And to you, you thought it was so bad that you just could not stomach continuing on with the series.
Yeah, well, I just thought it was just, yeah, just like the dull, tedious, dull, like, and really just flat.
See, I thought the pilot had enough potential that I could see them doing something interesting with this universe, but I think they've really just squandered that potential.
Right.
You know, I see glimpses of it, like with the episode Krill, but then we come back to an episode like Majority Rule. I'm just like, and it was just tedious. I was just like, oh, bad. This is bad 90s TV writing, mm-hmm. like really bad. Anyways, sorry, that's the Ortonville Report. Tune in for me to rag on the show that you love so much next week.
Okay, so on that note, our assignment is complete. Jump on over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod for all sorts of other Discovery-related content. We have, of course, the video recaps, but also, you know, the blogs that we do every week. Tyler, what did you talk about on last week's blog?
Yeah, so I did a fun comparison between Lethe and Tapestry, which is one of those classic episodes featuring Q, and how some bad things usually happen when it comes to our main character's graduation days. And so there's a lot of trauma that's involved there, and I kind of dive into it. So that was fun. Cam, what did you cover?
Yeah, I compared Lethe to the 2000 film The Cell, starring J-Lo. Because, you know, watching that episode, there's a lot of parallels to The Matrix. And I began to sit there and go, like, am I going to be writing about The Matrix? That feels like such a well-worn subject to be writing about. And then I realized that, no, it feels a lot more like The Cell. And there's some really interesting comparisons between that film that feels a little forgotten and the episode. And I think some of them may surprise you. So check that out, again, over at facebook.com/subspacepod.
Yeah, the other thing is, I think we said every time we get, like, what, 100 followers or something like that, we're going to add another episode commentary.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if you want to be able to find these exclusive Facebook episode commentaries, we'll be doing one after Discovery wraps, so look for it to, you know, hit, I would say, mid to late November. Cam, you know, we haven't decided an episode yet, but I don't know if anybody has any ideas about kind of a episode commentary they want to hear from us. Like, send us a message, post on the Facebook page or what have you. We're open to ideas.
Maybe we could put up a poll.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. Something like that. Okay, so next week we'll be back with the 8th episode of Discovery. Oh boy, this is a tough one to pronounce, folks, but C.V. Patium Parabolum.
What does that mean, Cam?
I have no idea. I'll have to look it up, and I'll also have to look up how to properly pronounce it for next week.
Yes, yes.
Okay, so you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V is in very intriguing, Ash Tyler is, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin, that's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N, N is in not a fish, technically.
Okay, and Andy.
You can find me at Sockbot. S for Stamets. S-O-C-K-B-O-T.
Nice.
Nice. Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed. Right now, yeah, yeah. Well, you can't tell by the way I roll, shorty, that I'm a ladies man, a businessman. Condos down the shore, multi-million pension plan. Uh-huh. But it ain't in my plan to make moves without the fan. No, can't I keep do. It intact, yo, clef, through the track. Clef, through the John, track. Play the Mac, yeah. While I pay the tax. Business as usual, watching suspects. Still my assets get cut with she lets. We built this concept, connect like 9X. Right. Drinks at the bar, my American Express. Transfer complete.